This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson, performed by Mary Robinette Kowal and Will Damron. To Jamie, Maria, Marco, and Jeff. Part 1. The Age of the One Moon. The moon blew up without warning and for no apparent reason. It was waxing, only one day short of full. The time was 05:03:12 UTC. Later, it would be designated A plus 0.0.0, or simply 0. An amateur astronomer in Utah was the first person on Earth to realize that something unusual was happening. Moments earlier, he had noticed a blur flourishing in the vicinity of the Rainier Gamma formation near the moon's equator. He assumed it was a dust cloud thrown up by a meteor strike. He pulled out his phone and blogged the event, moving his stiff thumbs, for he was high on a mountain and the air was as cold as it was clear, as fast as he could to secure the claim to himself. Other astronomers would soon be pointing their telescopes at the same dust cloud, might be doing it already. But, supposing he could move his thumbs fast enough, he would be the first to point it out. The fame would be his. If the meteorite left behind a visible crater, perhaps it would even bear his name. His name was forgotten. By the time he had gotten his phone out of his pocket, his crater no longer existed, nor did the moon. When he pocketed his phone and put his eye back to the eyepiece of his telescope, he let out a curse, since all he saw was a tawny blur. He must have knocked the telescope out of focus. He began to twiddle the focus knob. This didn't help. Finally, he pulled back from the telescope and looked with his naked eyes at the place where the moon was supposed to be. In that moment, he ceased to be a scientist with privileged information and became no different from millions of other people around the Americas, gaping in awe and astonishment at the most extraordinary thing that humans had ever seen in the sky. In movies, when a planet blows up, it turns into a fireball and ceases to exist. This is not what happened to the moon. The agent, as people came to call the mysterious force that did it, released a very large amount of energy, to be sure, but not nearly enough to turn all the moon's substance into fire. The most generally accepted theory was that the puff of dust observed by the Utah astronomer was caused by an impact. That the agent, in other words, came from outside the moon, pierced its surface, burrowed deep into its center, and then released its energy. Or that it simply kept on going out the other side, depositing enough energy en route to break up the moon. Another hypothesis stated that the agent was a device buried in the moon by aliens during primordial times, set to detonate when certain conditions were met. In any case, the result was that, first, the moon was fractured into seven large pieces, as well as innumerable smaller ones. And second, those pieces spread apart, enough to become observable as separate objects, huge, rough boulders, but not enough to continue flying apart from one another. The moon's pieces remained gravitationally bound, a cluster of giant rocks orbiting chaotically about their common center of gravity. That point, formerly the center of the moon, but now an abstraction in space, continued to revolve around the Earth just as it had done for billions of years. So now, when the people of Earth looked up into the night sky at the place where they ought to have seen the moon, they saw instead this slowly tumbling constellation of white boulders. Or at least, that is what they saw when the dust cleared. For the first few hours, what had been the moon was just a somewhat greater-than-moon-sized cloud, which reddened before the dawn and set in the west as the Utah astronomer looked on dumbfounded. Asia looked up all night at a moon-colored blur. Within, bright spots began to stand out as dust particles fell into the nearest heavy pieces. Europe, and then America, were treated to a clear view of the new state of affairs. Seven giant rocks where the moon ought to have been. Before the leaders of the scientific, military, and political worlds began using the word agent to denote whatever had blown up the moon, that word's most common interpretation, at least in the minds of the general public, had been in the pulp fiction, B-movie sense of a secret agent or an FBI agent. Persons of a more technical mindset might have used it to mean some sort of chemical, such as a cleaning agent. The closest match for how the word would be used forever after was the sense in which it was used by fencers and martial artists. In a sword-fighting drill, where one participant is going to mount an attack and the other is to respond in some way, the attacker is known as the agent, and the respondent is known as the patient. The agent acts. The patient is passive. In this case, an unknown agent acted upon the moon. The moon, along with all the humans living in the sublunary realm, was the passive recipient of that action. Much later, humans might rouse themselves to take action and be agents once again. But now, and for long into the future, they would be nothing more than patients. The Seven Sisters. Rufus Macquarie saw it all happen above the black ridgeline of the Brooks Range in northern Alaska. Rufus operated a mine there. On clear nights, he would drive his pickup truck to the top of a mountain that he and his men had spent the day hollowing out. He would take his telescope, a 12-inch cassegrain, out of the back of the truck and set it up on the summit and look at the stars. When he got ridiculously cold, he would retreat into the cab of his truck. He kept the engine running. And hold his hands over the heater vents until his fingers regained feeling. Then, as the rest of him warmed up, he would put those fingers to work communicating with friends, family, and strangers all over the world. And off it. After the moon blew up and he convinced himself that what he was seeing was real, he fired up an app that showed the positions of various natural and man-made celestial bodies. He checked the position of the International Space Station. It happened to be swinging across the sky 260 miles above and 2,000 miles south of him. He pulled a contraption onto his knee. He had made it in his little machine shop. It consisted of a telegraph key that looked to be about 150 years old, mounted on a contoured plastic block that strapped to his knee with hook and loop. He began to rattle off dots and dashes. A whip antenna was mounted to the bumper of his pickup truck, reaching for the stars. 260 miles above and 2,000 miles south of him, the dots and dashes came out of a pair of cheap speakers zip-tied to a conduit in a crowded can-shaped module that made up part of the International Space Station. Bolted to one end of the ISS was the yam-shaped asteroid called Amalthea, in the unlikely event that it could have been brought gently to Earth and laid to rest on a soccer field, it would have stretched from one penalty box to the other and completely covered the center circle. It had floated around the sun for 4.5 billion years, invisible to the naked eye and to astronomers' telescopes, even though its orbit had been similar to that of the Earth. In the classification system used by astronomers, this meant that it was called an Argina asteroid. Because of their near-Earth orbits, Arginas had a high probability of entering the Earth's atmosphere and slamming into inhabited places. But, by the same token, they were also relatively easy to reach and latch onto. For both those reasons, bad and good, they drew the attention of astronomers. Amalthea had been noticed 5 years earlier by a swarm of telescope-wielding satellites sent out by Argina Expeditions, a Seattle-based company funded by tech billionaires for the express purpose of asteroid mining. It had been identified as dangerous. With a 0.01% probability of striking the Earth within the next 100 years, and so another swarm of satellites had been sent up to drop a bag over it and drag it into a geocentric, Earth rather than sun-centered orbit, which had then been gradually matched with that of the ISS. In the meantime, the planned expansion of the ISS had plotted onward. New modules, inflatables, and air-filled tin cans sent up on rockets had been added to the space station at both ends. At the forward end, the space station's nose, if you thought of it as a vaguely bird-shaped object flying around the world, a home was prepared for Amalthea and for the asteroid mining research project that was planned to grow up around it. Meanwhile, at the aft end, a torus, a donut-shaped habitat about 40 meters in diameter, was constructed and made to spin like a merry-go-round, creating a small amount of simulated gravity. At some point during these improvements, people had stopped calling it the International Space Station, or ISS, and began referring to the old girl as Izzy. Coincidentally or not, this moniker had become popular around the time that each of the station's two ends had come under the management of a woman. Dinah Macquarie, the fifth child and only daughter of Rufus, was responsible for much of what went on in Izzy's forward end. Ivy Shao had overall command of ISS and tended to operate out of the Taurus at its stern. During most of Dinah's waking hours, she was at the forward end of Izzy, in a small workspace, my shop, where she could look out a small quartz window at Amalthea, my girlfriend. Amalthea was nickel and iron, heavy elements that had probably sunk to the hot center of an ancient planet long since blown apart by some primordial catastrophe. Other asteroids were made of lighter materials. In the same way that Amalthea's Earth-like orbit had made her both a dire threat and a promising candidate for exploitation, her dense metallic constitution had made her a bitch to move around the solar system, but a rewarding object of study. Some asteroids were made largely of water, which could be hoarded for consumption by humans or split into hydrogen and oxygen to fuel rockets. Others were rich in precious metals that could be returned to Earth and sold. A lump of nickel and iron like Amalthea could be smelted into structural materials for the construction of orbiting space habitats. Doing so on anything more than a small pilot scale would require the development of new technology. Using human miners was out of the question, since sending them up to orbit and keeping them alive was expensive. Robots were the obvious solution. Dinah had been sent up to Izzy to lay groundwork for a robot laboratory that would eventually host a staff of six. The budget wars in Washington had reduced that number to one, which was how she actually liked it. She had grown up in remote places, following her father, Rufus, her mother, Catherine, and her four brothers to a series of hard rock mines in places like the Brooks Range of Alaska, the Karoo Desert of South Africa, and the Pilbara of Western Australia. Her accent betrayed traces of all those places. She'd been homeschooled by her parents and a series of tutors they'd flown in, none of whom had lasted more than a year. Catherine had taught her the finer points of piano playing and napkin folding, and Rufus had taught her mathematics, military history, Morse code, bush piloting, and how to blow things up, all by the age of 12, when, by family voice vote over dinner, she had been deemed too smart and too much of a handful for life at the Minehead. She had been sent off to a boarding school on the east coast of the United States. For her family, though she'd never had an inkling of it until then, was well off. At school, she had developed into a gifted soccer player and parlayed this talent into an athletic scholarship to Penn. During her sophomore year, she had blown out her right ACL, terminating her serious athletic career, and turned her attention in a more serious way to the study of geology. That, plus a 3-year relationship with a boy who liked to build robots, combined with her background in the mining industry, had made her into a perfect candidate for the job she had now. Working hand in glove with robot geeks on Terra Firma, a mixture of university researchers, freelance members of the Hacker Maker community, and paid Arjuna Expedition's staff, she programmed, tested, and evaluated a menagerie of robots, ranging in size from cockroach to cocker spaniel, all adapted for the task of crawling around on the surface of Amalthea, analyzing its mineral composition, cutting bits off, and then taking them to a smelter that, like everything else up here, was specially adapted to work in the environment of space. The ingots of steel that emerged from this device were barely large enough to serve as paperweights, but they were the first such things made off-world, and right now, they were weighing down important papers on billionaires' desks all over Silicon Valley, worth far more as conversation pieces and status symbols than as commodities. Rufus, a die-hard ham radio enthusiast who still communicated in Morse code with a dwindling circle of old friends all around the world, had pointed out that radio transmission between the ground and Izzy was actually rather easy, given that it was line of sight, at least when Izzy happened to be passing overhead, and that the distance was nothing by ham radio standards. Since Dinah lived and worked in a robot workshop, surrounded by soldering gear and electronics workbenches, it had been a simple matter for her to assemble a small transceiver following specifications provided by her dad. Zip-tied to a bulkhead, it dangled above her workstation, making a dim static hiss that was easily drowned out by the normal background roar of the space station's ventilation systems. Sometimes it would beep. A spacewalker gazing at Dinah's end of Izzy, a few minutes after the agent had fractured the moon, would have seen, first of all, Amalthea. A huge, gnarled twist of metal, still dusty in some places with space debris that had fallen into its evanescent gravitational field over the eons, gleaming in others where it had been rubbed clean. Scurrying over its surface was a score of different robots, belonging to four distinct species. One that looked like a snake, one that picked its way along like a crab, one that looked like a sort of rolling geodesic dome, and another that looked like a swarm of insects. These provided sporadic illumination from the blue and white LEDs that Dinah used to track them, from the lasers with which they scanned Amalthea's surface, and from the blinding arcs of purplish light with which they would sometimes slice into it. Izzy was then in Earth's shadow on the night side of the planet, and so all was dark otherwise, except for white light spilling out from the little quartz window beside Dinah's workstation. This was barely large enough to frame her head. She had straw-colored hair cut short. She had never been especially appearance-conscious. Back at the Minehead, her brothers had mocked her to shame whenever she had experimented with clothes or cosmetics. When she'd been described as a tomboy in a school yearbook, she had interpreted it as a sort of warning shot, and had gone into a somewhat more girly phase that had run its course during her late teens and early 20s and ended when she had started to worry about being taken seriously in engineering meetings. Being on Izzy meant being on the Internet, doing everything from painstakingly scripted NASA PR interviews to candid Facebook shots posted by fellow astronauts. She had grown tired of the poofy floating hair of zero gravity, and after a few weeks of clamping it down with baseball caps, had figured out how to make this shorter cut work for her. The haircut had spawned terabytes of internet commentary from men and a few women, who apparently had nothing else to do with their time. As usual, she was focused on the screen of her computer, which was covered with lines of code governing the behavior of her robots. Most software developers had to write code, compile it into a program, and then run the program to see whether it was working as intended. Dinah wrote code, beamed it into the robot scurrying around on Amalthea's surface a few meters away, and stared out the window to see whether it was working. The ones closest to the window tended to get most of her attention, and so there was a kind of natural selection at work, in that the robots that huddled closest to their mother's cool blue-eyed gaze acquired the most intelligence, while the ones wandering around loose on the dark side never got any smarter. At any rate, her focus was either on the screen or on the robots, and so it had been for many hours. Until a string of beeps came out of the hissing speaker zip-tied to the bulkhead, and her eyes went momentarily out of focus as her brain decoded the dots and dashes into a string of letters and numbers. Her father's call sign. "Not now, Pa," she muttered, with a guilty daughter's glance at the brass and oak telegraph key he had given her, a Victorian relic purchased at great price on eBay, during a bidding war that had placed Rufus into pitched battle against a host of science museums and interior decorators. Look at the moon. Not now, Pa. I know the moon's pretty. I'm right in the middle of debugging this method, or what used to be it. Huh? And then she brought her face close to the window and twisted her neck to find the moon. She saw what used to be it, and the universe changed. His name was Dubois Jerome Xavier Harris, Ph.D. The French first name came from his Louisiana ancestors on his mother's side. The Harrises were Canadian blacks whose ancestors had come up to Toronto during slavery. Jerome and Xavier were the names of saints, two of them, just to be on the safe side. The family straddled the border in the Detroit-Windsor area. Inevitably, he had been dubbed Dube by his friends at school, when they had still been too young to understand that doobie was slang for a marijuana cigarette. The overwhelming majority of people called him Doc Dubois now, because he was on TV a lot, and that was how the talk show hosts and the network anchorman introduced him. His job on TV was to explain science to the general public and, as such, to act as a lightning rod for people who could not accept all the things that science implied about their worldview and their way of life, and who showed a kind of harebrained ingenuity in finding ways to refute it. In academic settings, such as when he was keynoting astronomical meetings and writing papers, he was, of course, Dr. Harris. The moon blew up while he was attending a fundraising reception in the courtyard of the Caltech Athenaeum. At the beginning of the evening, it was a fiercely cold bluish-white disk rising above the Chino Hills. Lay observers would fancy it a good night for moon watching, at least by Southern California standards. But Dr. Harris's professional eye saw a thin border of fuzz around its rim and knew that aiming a telescope at it would be pointless, at least if the objective were to do science. Public relations was another matter. Operating more in his Doc Dubois persona, he occasionally organized star parties where amateur astronomers would set their telescopes up in Eaton Canyon Park and aim them at crowd-pleasing targets, such as the moon, the rings of Saturn, and the moons of Jupiter. Tonight would be a fine night for that. But that wasn't what he was doing. He was drinking good red wine with rich persons, mostly from the tech industry, and being Doc Dubois, the affable science popularizer of television and of 4 million Twitter followers. Doc Dubois knew how to size up his audience. He knew that self-made tech-zillionaires liked to argue, that Pasadena aristocracy didn't, and that society wives liked to be lectured to, as long as the lectures were brief and funny. And he knew that his job was to charm these people, nothing more, so that they could later be handed off to professional fundraisers. He was going back to the bar for another glass of the Pinot Noir, fully in the Doc Dubois persona, slapping shoulders and bumping fists and exchanging grins, when a man gasped. Everyone looked at him. Dube was afraid that the poor guy had been struck by a stray bullet or something. He was frozen, poised on one leg, gazing up. A woman followed his gaze and screamed. And Dube became one of perhaps a few million people around the dark half of the planet, all looking up into the sky, in a state of shock so profound as to shut off the parts of the brain responsible for higher functions like talking. His first thought, given that they were in Greater Los Angeles, was that they were looking at a black projection screen that had been stealthily hoisted into the air above the neighboring property and were seeing a Hollywood special effect thrown onto it by a concealed projector. No one had informed him that any such stunt was underway, but perhaps it was some incredibly bizarre fundraising gambit, or part of a movie production. When he came to his senses, he was aware that a large number of telephones were singing their little electronic songs, including his. The birth cry of a new age. Ivy Shao was in overall command of Izzy and spent almost all of her time in the Taurus, partly because her office was there, and partly because she was more susceptible to space sickness than she liked to admit. That physical separation, Ivy back in the Taurus, Dinah up in the forward end, close to Amalthea, was symbolic, in many people's minds, of a difference between them that didn't really exist. Other contrasts were obvious enough, beginning with the physical. Ivy was 4 inches taller, with long black hair that she kept under control, usually by braiding it, and trapping the braid under the collar of her jumpsuit. She had the build of a volleyball player. Raised in Los Angeles, the only child of high-strung parents, Ivy had SAT'd, science fair'd, and spiked her way to Annapolis, then followed that up with a PhD in applied physics from Princeton. Only then had the Navy demanded the years of service that she owed it in return for her tuition. After learning how to pilot helicopters, she had spent most of that time in the astronaut program, in whose ranks she had risen quickly. Unlike most astronauts, who were mission specialists, scientists or engineers carrying out specific tasks after the launch vehicle had reached orbit, Ivy, with her training as a pilot, was a flight specialist as well, meaning that she knew how to fly rockets. The days of the space shuttle were long over, so there was no need to joystick a winged vehicle back to a runway. But docking and maneuvering spacecraft in orbit was a good, clean match for someone with the motor control of a chopper pilot and the mathematical mind of a physicist. The pedigree was intimidating, even off-putting to people who were impressed by such things. Dinah, who wasn't, cared little one way or the other. Her informal behavior toward Ivy was interpreted by some observers as disrespectful. Two very different women in conflict with each other made for a more dramatic story than what was actually true. They were continually bemused by the efforts made by Izzy's personnel and their handlers on the ground to heal the non-existent rift between them, or, what was a lot less funny, to exploit it in the pursuit of Byzantine political schemes. 4 hours after the moon blew up, Dinah and Ivy and the other 10 crew members of the International Space Station had a meeting in the Banana, which was what they called the longest uninterrupted section in the spinning torus. Most of the torus was chopped up into segments short enough that the brain could talk the eye into believing that the floor was flat and that gravity always pointed in the same direction. But the Banana was long enough to make it obvious that the floor was in fact curved through about 50 degrees of arc from one end to the other. Gravity at one end of it was aimed in a different direction from that at the other end. Accordingly, the long conference table that ran down its length was curved too. People entering into one end looked uphill to the opposite end, but experienced no sensation of climbing as they moved toward it. New arrivals tended to expect that anything placed elsewhere on the table would roll and slide down toward them. The walls were pale yellow. The usual collection of malfunctioning audiovisual equipment purported to show live video streams of people on the ground, in theory, enabling them to teleconference with colleagues in Houston, Baikonur, or Washington. When the meeting began at A plus 0.0.4, 0 years, 0 days, and 4 hours since the agent had acted upon the moon, nothing was working. And so the occupants of Izzy had a few minutes to talk among themselves while Frank Casper and Gibran Haroun wiggled connectors, typed commands into computers, and rebooted everything. Relatively new arrivals to Izzy, Frank and Gibran had made the mistake of letting on that they were good at that sort of thing, so they always got saddled with it. Both of them were more comfortable with it anyway than with making chit-chat. Primordial singularity were the first words Dinah heard upon gliding into the room. Gravity here was only one-tenth of that on Earth, and walking wasn't the right word for how people moved around. It was halfway between that and flying, a sort of long, bounding gait. The words had been spoken by Conrad Barth, a German astronomer. It was clear from how the others reacted that Ivy, who was sitting directly across the table from him, was the only other person in the Banana who had the faintest idea what he was talking about. "And that is?" Dinah asked, since that sort of thing had become her role. Others tended to be so worshipful of Ivy or so reluctant to show ignorance that they wouldn't ask.
"A small black hole."
"Why primordial?" Most black holes are formed when stars collapse, Ivy said. But there's a theory that some of them were created shortly after the Big Bang. The universe was lumpy. Some of the lumps might have been dense enough to undergo gravitational collapse. They could form black holes that, instead of weighing what a star weighs, would be a lot smaller. How small? I don't think there's a lower limit. But the point is that one of them could zip through space invisibly and punch all the way through a planet and out the other side. There used to be a theory that the Tunguska event was caused by one, but that's been disproved. Dinah knew about that because her dad liked to talk about it. A huge explosion in Siberia 100 years ago that had knocked down millions of trees out in the middle of nowhere. That was a big deal, Dinah said, but not enough to blow up the moon. To blow up the moon would take a bigger one going faster, Ivy said. Look, it's just a hypothesis. But it's gone now? It would be long gone now, like a bullet through an apple. It struck Dinah as odd that they were talking about such an event so matter-of-factly. But there was no other way to address it. Emotions were not large enough to encompass such a thing. Besides, it was just a visual effect so far, like something seen in a movie with the sound turned off. Is it going to affect the tides? Asked Lena Ferreira. A marine biologist, Lena would naturally be somewhat concerned about the tides. Since those are caused by the moon's gravity. And by the sun's, Ivy added with a nod and a little smile, which was why she was in charge of Izzy and Dinah wasn't. She was willing to correct a PhD marine biologist in front of a room full of people, but she could carry it off in a way that didn't sting. But the answer is probably surprisingly little. The moon's mass is still all there, close to where it was before. It's just spread out a little. But the pieces still have the same collective center of gravity, still in the same orbit as the moon had before. Your tide tables will still pretty much work. Dinah's facial expression was blank, but she was enjoying Ivy's ability to talk about science with a kind of little nerd girl sense of wonder, even in spite of the disturbing subject matter. This was why Ivy always got the media interviews, while Dinah had to be dragged out of her den of robots and told over and over again to smile. The tone of voice was the giveaway. When Ivy was giving orders or reading PowerPoint slides, she went clipped and military. But when she talked about science, her face opened up and her voice went into a vaguely Mandarin sing-songy lilt. "Where are you getting all this?" Dinah asked, drawing startled or disapproving glances from a few who worried that she was being too brusque with the boss. It's only been, what, 4 hours? There's a lot of noisy comment thread traffic, as you'd expect, and a few ad hoc email lists sort of congealing out of that, Ivy explained. A blue screen appeared on the lightweight monitor stretched above one end of the long table and was replaced by a NASA logo.
Okay, got it,
muttered Gibran, who made a sideways bound toward a chair. Then they were looking at the familiar environs of the ISS flight control room, which was at Johnson Space Center in Houston. The director of mission operations was sitting in front of the camera stroking his iPad. He didn't seem to be aware that the camera was on. A few moments later, they heard a door open off camera. The DMO, who was ex-military, stood up out of habit. He reached out and shook hands with a woman who entered from stage right. NASA's deputy administrator, the number 2 person in the whole org chart, and a rare sight at such meetings. She was a retired astronaut named Aurelia Mackey, dressed for business in the environment of D.C., where she spent most of her time.
"Are we on?"
she asked someone off camera.
"Yes,"
said several people in the banana. Aurelia looked a little startled by that. Both she and the DMO were looking a little stunned to begin with, of course.
"How are you all today?"
Aurelia said in an absolutely rote, business-like voice as if nothing had happened, running on autopilot while her brain caught up with events.
"Fine,"
said some people in the banana, mixed in with a few nervous chuckles.
"I'm sure you are all aware of the event." "We have a good view of it,"
Dinah said. Ivy shot her a warning look.
"Of course you do,"
Aurelia admitted.
I would love to have an extended conversation with you all about what you have seen and what you are experiencing, but this is going to have to be brief. Robert?"
The DMO peeled his eyes off the iPad and sat forward in his chair.
"We're expecting an increase in the number of rocks floating around up there."
He meant loose chunks of the moon.
"Not huge, because most will be gravitationally bound, but some may have escaped. So other missions are suspended while you batten down the hatches. Make preparations for impacts."
Everyone in the banana listened silently, thinking about what that would mean for them. They would tighten precautions, dividing Izzy up into separate compartments so that damage to one wouldn't suck the air from all. They would review procedures. Lena's biology experiments might take a hit. Dinah's robots would enjoy a holiday. Aurelia spoke into the camera.
"All spaceflight operations are suspended until further notice. No one is coming up, and no one is going down."
Everyone in the banana looked at Ivy. As soon as they got into Ivy's tiny office, where she felt it was okay to let tears come into her eyes, they slipped into their Q code. Q codes were ham radio slang. Dinah had learned them from Rufus. They were three-letter combinations, beginning with Q. To save time in Morse code transmissions, they were substituted for frequently used phrases such as, "Would you like me to change to a different frequency?" Dinah and Ivy's Q codes didn't actually begin with Q, but some of them were three-letter combinations. Uppity Little Shitkicker was a name that had been hung on Dinah when she had first arrived at private school and, during a soccer scrimmage, intercepted a pass meant for a girl from New York. Straight Arrow Bitch had been bestowed on Ivy at Annapolis when she had declined to take part in a drinking game during a tailgate party. The ULS, SAB dynamic was a thing that Dinah and Ivy exploited in meetings, even having meetings before meetings to plan how to use it. Good Looks Wasted had found its way to Dinah in the aftermath of her new haircut, as the result of an improbable chain of reply-to-all mishaps. She had brought it to Ivy, breathless with excitement, and they had enshrined GLW in their private codebook.
"I forgot."
When spoken in a breathy little girl voice was a shorthand way of saying, "I forgot to put on my makeup," quoted verbatim from a NASA PR flack. SAR was from a tart exchange between Ivy and a NASA administrator who, upon reading one of her reports, had criticized her for having an almost pathological predilection for unnecessary abbreviations. This had struck Ivy as a bit odd, given that every other word in NASA prose was an acronym. When Ivy had asked for clarification, she had been told that her abbreviations were schoolgirlish and recondite. Space camp, which both Ivy and Dinah had attended as teens, though at different times, was what they called not just Izzy, but the whole subculture of NASA manned spaceflight. "What are you going to say to the maternal organism?" Dinah asked, as Ivy rummaged in the back of a storage bin for her bottle of tequila. Ivy stiffened for a moment, then pulled out the bottle and swung it toward Dinah's head like a club. Dinah didn't flinch, just watched it glide to a halt above her head. "What?"
"I can't believe that the morgue has so taken over my wedding that the first thing that comes into your mind is how she's going to react."
Dinah looked mildly sick.
"Don't worry about it," Ivy said. "You forgot to put on your makeup."
"Sorry, baby. I was just thinking. You and Cal are still going to get married and have a great life no matter what."
"But the morgue is going to take the hit," Ivy said, nodding as she poured tequila into a pair of small plastic cups. "Having to reschedule everything."
"Sounds like she's kind of in her element doing that, though," Dinah said, not to minimize it or anything.
"Totally.
To the morgue."
"The morgue."
Dinah and Ivy tapped their plastic cups together and sipped at the tequila. One of the fringe benefits that came of being in the Taurus was that you could drink normally instead of sucking everything through tubes. The lower gravity took some getting used to, but they were old hands at it by now.
"What's up with your family?"
Did you hear from Rufus?
Ivy asked. My father desires raw data files from Conrad's wide-field infrared observation platform, which he has read about on the Internet, so that he can satisfy his personal curiosity about the thing that hit the moon.
You're going to Morse code those down to him?
His Internet is working. He's already created an empty Dropbox folder. As soon as I provide him with the files, he'll go back to his usual grousing about how his taxes are too high and the federal government needs to be scaled back to a size where he can personally stomp it to death with steel-toed boots. What astronomers didn't know outweighed, by an almost infinite ratio, what they did. And so for persons used to a more orderly system of knowledge, with everything on Wikipedia, this created a certain perception of incompetence, or at least failure to perform, on the part of the astronomical profession whenever weird things happened in the sky. Which was every day, actually. But most of them could be seen only by astronomers, and so they were able to keep them a sort of trade secret. Blatantly obvious events, such as meteorite strikes, caused Doc Dubois' phone to sing. The singing usually portended a series of appearances on talk shows where, among other things, he would be asked to explain why astronomers hadn't predicted this. Why hadn't they seen the meteor coming? Wasn't it just the case that they were a bunch of good-for-nothing propeller heads? A little bit of humility seemed to go a long way, and if the pundits didn't cut him off too soon, he was frequently able to work in a plea for more government support of science. For members of the general public might not care about Wolf-Rayet stars in the quintuplet cluster, but they definitely saw why having hot rocks fall on one's head was a good thing to avoid. He always called it the breakup of the moon, not the explosion. The term began to gain traction on Twitter, with hashtag BUM. Whatever you called it, it was an infinitely bigger deal than a single meteor strike, so it seemed to demand more explanation. But there was no way to explain it yet. Meteors were easy. Space was full of rocks too small and dark to be seen through telescopes, and some of them snagged on the atmosphere and fell to ground. But the breakup of the moon could not have been caused by any normal astronomical phenomenon. So Doc Dubois, who spent most of the next week on camera, got out in front of that issue at every chance, always leading with a frank statement that neither he nor any other astronomer knew the cause. That was the pitch, straight down the middle. Then he added the spin. This is absolutely fascinating. It is, as a matter of fact, the most fascinating scientific event in human history. It looks scary and upsetting, but the fact is that no one has been killed by it, save for a few drivers who swerved off roads or rear-ended stopped traffic while rubbernecking. At A plus 0.4.16, 4 days and 16 hours after the breakup of the moon, he had to amend "no one has been killed" when a meteorite, almost certainly a chunk of moon rock, entered the atmosphere over Peru, shattered windows along a 20-mile track, and smashed into a farmstead, obliterating a small family. But the message remained the same. Let's look at this as a scientific phenomenon and start with what we know. His friend was a video streaming site called Astronomical Bodies, formerly known as themoon.com, which kept a high-resolution feed of the rubble cloud running around the clock. As soon as possible in the interview, Doc Dubois would get that up on the screen and then begin making observations about the cloud, because making observations calmed people down. The moon had broken up into seven large pieces, which inevitably became known as the Seven Sisters, and an uncountable number of smaller ones. Gradually, the big ones acquired names. Doc Dubois was responsible for many of these. He gave them descriptive names that wouldn't scare people. It wouldn't do to call them Nemesis, or Thor, or Grand. So instead it was Potato Head, Mr. Spinny, Acorn, Peach Pit, Scoop, Big Boy, and Kidney Bean.
Doc Dubois would point those out and then draw attention to the way they moved. This was governed entirely by Newtonian mechanics. Each piece of the moon attracted every other piece more or less strongly depending on its mass and its distance. It could be simulated on a computer quite easily. The whole rubble cloud was gravitationally bound. Any shrapnel fast enough to escape had done so already. The rest was drifting around in a loose huddle of rocks. Sometimes they banged into one another. Eventually, they would stick together and the moon would begin to reform. Or at least, that was the theory, until the star party that they threw in the middle of the Caltech campus at A plus 0.7.0, exactly 1 week after the event. Normally, they held the star parties up in the hills, where the seeing was better. But seeing giant rocks close to the Earth was so easy that there was no need to go to the trouble of driving up into the mountains. It would have undercut the purpose of the event, which was to get as many members of the general public as possible out in a park-like atmosphere to peer through telescopes and make observations. The Beckman Mall was lined with yellow school buses, interspersed here and there with vans from local and network television, their masts deployed so that they could relay live video downtown. Their reporters stood in pools of light, using as a backdrop an open green strewn with telescopes of various types and sizes. Little seven-card decks were handed out, each card depicting a different fragment of the moon from various angles and identifying it by its name. Kids were given the assignment to identify each of the rocks through the eyepiece of a telescope, check it off on a homework sheet, and write down an observation about it. Most of the scopes, obviously, were pointed at the Seven Sisters, but one contingent was looking at a darker part of the sky with binoculars or just their naked eyes, expecting to see meteorites. By day seven, several hundred of these had entered the atmosphere. Or at least several hundred large enough to be noticed. Most had burned up before hitting the ground. There had been about a score of incidents in which they drew arc-light trails across the sky, illuminating the ground below with freaky bluish radiance and producing huge sonic booms. Half a dozen had struck the ground, doing greater or lesser amounts of damage. The death toll, though, was still far beneath the statistical ground clutter of shark attacks and lightning strikes. The evening went fine. Doob, who had raised three children to adulthood, had figured out a long time ago that any event largely organized by elementary school teachers was likely to come off extremely well from a logistical and crowd control standpoint. So he was able to relax and be Doc, autographing Seven Sisters cards for kids, and occasionally slipping into Dr. Harris mode for a discussion with a fellow astronomer. As he wandered about the place, he had three different chance encounters with the same elementary school teacher, one Ms. Ina Hosa, and fell in love with her. This was unusual. He had not been in love with anyone in 12 years. He had been divorced for 9. He found it nearly as shocking in its own way as the breakup of the moon. He tried to deal with it in the same way, by making scientific observations of the phenomenon. His working hypothesis was that the breakup of the moon had made Doob young again, exfoliating layers of emotional callus from his soul and leaving a pink, shiny, impressionable heart just waiting to be colonized by the first appealing woman who came along. He was talking to Amelia, for that, as it turned out, was her first name, when a buzz moved slowly over the quad, like a gentle breeze, and caused everyone to look up. Two of the larger pieces, Scoop and Kidney Bean, were headed right for each other. It would not be the first such collision. They happened all the time. But seeing two big chunks heading right for each other with high closing velocity was unusual and promised a good show. Doob tried to quiet an unsettled feeling in his chest, which might have been caused by what was happening with Amelia, or by the natural trepidation that any sane person would feel upon seeing two enormous pieces of rock getting ready to smash into each other directly overhead. The good news was that people were beginning to treat the evolution of the swarm as a kind of spectator sport,
to see it as fascinating and fun, not terrifying. Scoop's sharper edge slammed into the divot that gave Kidney Bean its name and split it in half. It all happened, of course, in quiet, super slow motion. "And then there were eight," Amelia said. Instinctively, she had turned away from Doob and toward her brood of 22 students. "What just happened to Kidney Bean?" she was asking in that teacherly way, scanning for upraised hands, looking for a kid to call on. "Can anyone tell me?" The kids were silent and vaguely sick-looking. Amelia held up her Kidney Bean card and tore it in half. Dr. Harris was walking toward his car. His phone rang, so startling him that he almost swerved into a school bus. What was wrong with him? His scalp was tingling, and he realized it was his hairs trying to stand up on his head. He checked the screen of the phone and saw that the call was from a colleague in Manchester. He declined to answer it and found himself looking at a new contact that he had been creating for Amelia. A snapshot of her face, just a silhouette in profile against a bank of TV lights. And her phone number. He tapped the done button. He had felt that tingling in the scalp once before. On a safari in Tanzania, and had turned around to see that he was being watched, interestedly, by a group of hyenas. The thing that had scared him hadn't been the hyenas themselves. Those, and even more dangerous animals, were all over the place. Rather, it was the sudden awareness that he had let his guard down, that he had been focusing his attention on the wrong thing while the real danger had been circling around behind him. He had wasted a week on the fascinating scientific puzzle of what blew up the moon. That had been a mistake. Scouts.
"We need to stop asking ourselves what happened and start talking about what is going to happen,"
Dr. Harris said to the President of the United States, her science advisor, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and about half of the cabinet. He could see that the president didn't like that. Julia Bliss Flaherty, currently nearing the end of her first year on that job. The chairman of the JCS was nodding, but President Flaherty was giving him a hard, squinting look, and not just because of the light coming in the window from the skies over Camp David. She thought he was up to something, trying to shift blame, trying to push some kind of new agenda. "Go on," she said. Then, remembering her manners, "Dr. Harris."
"4 days ago, I watched Kidney Bean break in half,"
Doob said.
"The seven sisters became eight. Since then, we've seen a near miss that could have fractured Mr. Spinney."
"I would almost welcome it," said the president, "if we could get rid of those ridiculous names."
"It'll happen,"
Doob said.
"The question is, how long does Mr. Spinney have to live? And what does that tell us?"
He clicked a small remote in his hand and brought up a slide on the big screen. Heads turned toward it, and he felt a mild sense of relief at not being stared at anymore by the president. The slide was a montage of a snowball rolling down a hill, a fuzzy bacterial culture growing in a petri dish, a mushroom cloud, and other seemingly unrelated phenomena.
"What do these all have in common? They are exponential,"
he said.
"The word gets tossed around by a lot of people who use it to mean anything that's getting big fast. But it has a specific mathematical meaning. It means any process where the more it happens, the more it happens. The population explosion. A nuclear chain reaction. A snowball rolling down a hill whose speed of growth is pegged to how much it's grown."
He clicked through another slide showing plots of exponential curves on a graph, then to an image of the moon's eight pieces.
"When the moon had only one piece, the probability of a collision was zero,"
he said.
"Because there was nothing to collide with,"
Pete Starling, the president's science advisor, explained. The president nodded.
"Thank you, Dr. Starling. When you have two pieces, why then, yes, they can collide. The more pieces you get, the higher the chances of any two pieces banging into each other. But what happens when they bang into each other?
He clicked the control again and showed a little movie of Kidney Bean's breakup.
Well, sometimes, but not always, they break in half. Which means you have more pieces. 8 instead of 7. 9 instead of 8. And that increase in number means an increase in the odds of further collisions.
It's an exponential, said the chairman.
It occurred to me 4 days ago that it did have all the earmarks of an exponential process.
Dube allowed.
And we know what happens to those.
President Flaherty had been watching him intently, but she now flicked her eyes over to Pete Starling, who made a dramatic upward-zooming gesture with one hand, tracing the profile of a hockey stick.
When an exponential hits the bend in the hockey stick curve,
Dube said,
the result can be indistinguishable from a detonation, or it can look like a slow, steady increase. It all depends on the time constant, the inherent speed with which the exponential thing happens, and on how we perceive it as humans.
So it might be nothing, said the chairman.
It could be that 100 years will pass before we go from 8 chunks to 9 chunks,
Dube said, nodding at him.
But 4 days ago I got worried that it might be one of those things that looks more like an explosion. So my grad students and I have been crunching some numbers, building a mathematical model of the process that we can use to get a handle on the time scale.
And what are your results, Dr. Harris? I assume you have some or else you wouldn't be here.
The good news is that the Earth is one day going to have a beautiful system of rings, just like Saturn. The bad news is that it's going to be messy.
In other words, said Pete Starling, the chunks of the moon are going to keep banging into each other indefinitely and breaking up into smaller and smaller pieces, spreading out into a system of rings. But some rocks are going to fall on the ground and break things.
And can you tell me, Dr. Harris, when this is going to happen? Over what period of time?
The president asked.
We're still gathering data, tuning the model's parameters,
Dube said.
So my estimates could all be off by a factor of 2, maybe 3. Exponentials are tricky that way, but what it looks like to me is this.
He clicked through to a new graph, a blue curve showing a slow, steady climb over time.
The time scale at the bottom is something like 1 to 3 years. During that time, the number of collisions and the number of new fragments are going to grow steadily.
What is BFR?
Asked Pete Starling. For the graph's vertical scale was labeled thus.
Bolide fragmentation rate,
Dube said.
The rate at which new rocks are being produced.
Is that a standard term?
Pete wanted to know. His tone was not so much hostile as unnerved.
No,
Dube said.
I made it up yesterday, on the plane.
He was tempted to add something like,
I am allowed to coin terms,
but didn't want things to get snarky this early in the meeting. Seeing that Pete had been silenced, at least for a moment, Dube tried to get back into his rhythm.
We'll see an increasing number of meteorite impacts. Some will cause great damage, but overall, life is not going to change that much. But then,
he clicked again, and the plot bent sharply upward, turning white.
We are going to witness an event that I am calling the white sky. It'll happen over hours or days. The system of discrete planetoids that we can see up there now is going to grind itself up into a vast number of much smaller fragments. They are going to turn into a white cloud in the sky, and that cloud is going to spread out.
Click. The graph continued shooting upward, rocketing up into a new domain and turning red.
A day or two after the white sky event, we'll begin a thing I am calling the hard rain. Because not all of those rocks are going to stay up there. Some of them are going to fall into the Earth's atmosphere.
He turns the projector off. This was an unusual move, but it snapped them all out of PowerPoint hypnosis and forced them to look at him. The aides in the back of the room were still thumbing their phones, but they didn't matter.
By some,
Doob said.
I mean trillions.
The room remained silent.
It is going to be a meteorite bombardment such as the Earth has not seen since the primordial age, when the solar system was formed.
Doob said.
Those fiery trails we've been seeing in the sky lately, as the meteorites come in and burn up? There will be so many of those that they will merge into a dome of fire that will set aflame anything that can see it. The entire surface of the Earth is going to be sterilized. Glaciers will boil. The only way to survive is to get away from the atmosphere, go underground, or go into space.
Well, obviously that is very hard news, if it is true, the president said. They all sat and thought about it silently for a period of time that might have been 1 minute or five. We will have to do both, the president said. Go into space and underground. Obviously, the latter is easier.
Yes.
We can get to work building underground bunkers for... And she caught herself before saying something impolitic. For people to take refuge in. Doob didn't say anything. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said,
Dr. Harris, I'm an old logistics guy. I deal in stuff. How much stuff do we need to get underground? How many sacks of potatoes and rolls of toilet paper per occupant? I guess what I'm asking is, just how long is the hard rain going to last?
Doob said,
My best estimate is that it will last somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 years.
None of you will ever stand on terra firma, touch your loved ones, or breathe the atmosphere of your mother planet again, the president said. That is a terrible fate. And yet it is a better fate than 7 billion people trapped on the Earth's surface can hope for. The last ship home has sailed. From now on, launch vehicles will rise up into orbit, but they will not go back for 10,000 years. The 12 men and women in the banana sat in silence. Like the destruction of the moon itself, it was too big a thing for them to take in. Too large for human emotion to get around. Dinah focused on trivia, such as just how damned good JBF, the president, was at saying stuff like this.
Dr. Harris, said Conrad Barth, the astronomer. I am sorry, Madam President, but is it possible to get Dr. Harris back into the picture?
Of course, said Julia Bliss Flaherty, who, with some reluctance, stepped sideways, making room for the larger frame of Dr. Harris. Dinah thought that he looked shrunken and diminished compared to the famous TV scientist. Then she remembered what he had explained to them a few minutes ago and felt uncharitable for having drawn that comparison. What must it have been like to be the only man on Earth to know that the Earth was doomed?
Yes, Conrad,
he said.
Doob, I'm not disagreeing with your calculations, but has this been peer-reviewed? Is there a chance that there is some basic error? A misplaced decimal point, something?
Harris had begun nodding his head halfway through Conrad's question. It was not a happy kind of nod.
Conrad,
he said,
it's not just me.
We have signals intelligence suggesting that the Chinese figured it out a day before we did, the president said. And the British, the Indians, the French, Germans, Russians, Japanese, all of their scientists are coming to more or less the same conclusions.
2 years?
Dinah piped up. Her voice was hoarse, broken. Everyone looked at her.
Until the white sky?
People seem to be converging on that figure. Yeah,
Dr. Harris said.
25 months. Plus or minus 2.
I know that this is a terrible shock for all of you, said the president.
But I wanted the crew of the ISS to be among the first to know about it, because I need you. We, the people of the United States and of Earth, need you.
For what? Dinah asked. In no sense was she the official spokesman for Izzy's crew of 12. That was Ivy's job. But Dinah could tell, just from looking at her, that Ivy was in no condition to speak.
We are beginning to talk to our counterparts in other spacefaring nations about creating an ark, the president said. A repository of the entire genetic heritage of the Earth. We have 2 years to build it. 2 years to get as many people and as much equipment as we can into orbit. The nucleus of that ark is going to be Izzy.
Absurdly, Dinah felt a mild flicker of annoyance that JBF had appropriated their informal term for the ISS. But she knew how it was. She had spent enough time with the NASA PR people to understand. Things had to be humanized, to be given cute names. All the terrified kids down there who knew they were going to die would have to watch upbeat videos about how Izzy was going to carry the legacy of the dead planet through the hard rain. They would take out their crayons and draw cartoon pictures of Izzy with a Taurus halo and a big rock on her ass and a little anthropomorphic smiley face on the side of the Zvezda service module. Ivy spoke up for the first time in a while. A mere 2 weeks ago, the postponement of her wedding had seemed a big disappointment. But she had just been told that her fiancé, U.S. Navy Commander Cal Blankenship, was a dead man walking, and that she would never marry him, never touch him, never see him again except through a video link, to say nothing of everyone else she knew. She looked a little spacey. She was talking in her sing-songy voice.
"Madam President," she said, "I'm sure you know that there isn't much space up here to accommodate new people. I'm sure this must be a topic of discussion."
"Yes, of course," the president said. "Your job is to..."
"Pardon me, Madam President. Can I take this?"
Dr. Harris asked. Dinah noted the flick of the president's eyes, the look of shock on her face. The president of the United States had just been interrupted, shouldered out of the way. As a woman who had made her way up in the world, she probably had some raw nerve endings around that sort of thing. But this wasn't that. It wasn't JBF asking herself, "Did he interrupt me because I'm a woman?" They were past all of that now. This was her asking herself, "Did he interrupt me because the President of the United States doesn't matter anymore?"
"Is Lena there?"
Dr. Harris asked.
"Pan the camera around, please. Ah, there you are. Lena, I have read your articles about the swarming behaviors of fish in the Caribbean. Great stuff."
"I didn't know your interests extended to things underwater," said Lena Ferreira. "Thank you." People were funny, Dinah thought, talking like this at a time like this.
"The videos are amazing. They all move in tight formation, until a predator comes through. Then suddenly, a hole just opens up in the swarm, and the predator sails through it and doesn't catch a single fish. A moment later, they're back together again. Well, nothing's been decided yet, but..."
"You want to use swarming behavior in the Ark?"
"The proposal is called the Cloud Ark,"
the president cut back in, "and you have it correct.
Rather than putting all our eggs in one basket."
"Eggs and sperm,"
Jabram muttered in his Lancashire accent, so low that only Dinah picked it up.
"We will take a distributed architecture," JBF said, with perhaps too careful enunciation, as if she had learned the phrase 10 minutes ago. "Each of the ships that will make up the Cloud Ark will be autonomous to an extent. We will mass-produce them, I am told, and send them up just as fast as we can. They will swarm around Izzy. When it is safe to do so, they can dock together like Tinker Toys, and people can move from one to the other freely. But when a rock approaches, whoosh! And she spread her fingers apart, the purple, lacquered nails darting away from one another.
But what about Izzy?
Dinah wondered. She thought better of asking just now. In order to make ready for that, there are tasks for all of you, the president said. And that is why I asked the director to join us on this call,
meaning Scott Spaulding, the director of NASA.
I'm going to turn this over to Sparky so that he can walk you through the details. As you can imagine, I have some other concerns to look after, and so I am going to bid you goodbye at this point.
The 12 in the banana mustered a low murmur of thanks to usher the president out of whatever conference room this transmission was coming from. Someone torqued the camera around until it was pointing at Scott Spaulding. He had managed to find a blazer, but he was tieless, and probably would be for the remainder of his life. As a young astronaut, Sparky had been slated for an Apollo mission that had been canceled during the budget cutbacks of the early 1970s. He had stuck with the program, getting his PhD during the hiatus in manned spaceflight that followed. His run of bad luck had continued when a planned mission on Skylab was scrubbed because of the spacecraft's untimely descent into the atmosphere. His perseverance had paid off in the 1980s with a series of shuttle missions that had turned him into a past master of the astronaut corps, equally at home fixing busted solar panels and quoting the poetry of Rainer Maria Rilke. After a couple of decades working at tech startups with varying levels of success, he'd been brought back to NASA a few years ago as part of some dimly conceived repurposing of the agency's mission. Most of the people in the banana found him likable, if somewhat opaque, and had the general feeling that he would back them up in a pinch. Exactly what Rilke poem Sparky thought could address the world's current predicament, it was impossible to guess. For a moment there, after the camera swung around to autofocus on his sagging and creased face, it almost seemed like some poetry might be on the tip of his tongue. Then he shook it off and found the camera's lens with his pale eyes.
"Words fail me," he said, "so I'm just going to concentrate on business. Ivy, you remain in charge. There's no one better. Your job is to keep things running up there. Communicate with us down here. Let us know what you need. If, after all of that, you find yourself with some free time, let me know and I'll find you a hobby."
He winked, and from there he went down the list. Frank Casper, a Canadian electrical engineer, and Spencer Grindstaff, an American who specialized in communications and who had been doing mysterious work for intelligence agencies, were going to work on establishing the network infrastructure needed to support the activities of the Cloud Ark. Gibran, an instrumentation specialist, who was always getting roped into such problems anyway, would work with them. Fyodor Panteleimon, their grizzled spacewalk specialist, and Zeke Peterson, a more boyish-looking American Air Force pilot, who also had many hours of experience in spacesuits, would begin preparing for the arrival of new modules that, they were assured, were being designed and built with an un-NASA-like haste, and would begin arriving at Izzy in less than a month. Dinah found that time estimate to be ludicrously optimistic, until she remembered that, essentially, all the world's resources were being thrown at this. Conrad Barth was simply asked to stay on after the meeting for a talk with Doob. It was obvious enough that he would soon be repurposing every astronomical gadget on the space station to the problem of looking for incoming rocks. This was a topic no one wanted to dwell on. If Izzy got hit by a rock of any size, it was all over. In that sense, there really was no point in talking about it. The life scientists were Lena Ferreira, Margaret Coughlin, an Australian woman studying the effects of spaceflight on the human body, and Jun Ueda, a Japanese biophysicist running some lab experiments about the effects of cosmic rays on living tissues. Also in that general category was Marco Aldobrandi, an Italian engineer who focused on the more practical matter of running the life support systems that kept the rest of them alive. Of those four, Lena already had a special status in that she had actually done work on swarming.
It wasn't that closely related to what she had been doing on the space station, but now she was going to have to dust it off and make it her life's work. Sparky gave her carte blanche to hole up in a quiet place and cram her brain with papers on that topic for a little while, getting back up to speed. Margaret and June were told to put their more abstract research work out the airlock and work under Marco on readying Izzy for a large expansion in population. That covered 11 of the 12. So far, Sparky hadn't said a word to Dinah. Meetings had never been her strong suit. She felt like she was playing an away game whenever she sat down in a conference room. Her awareness of this got in the way and turned into a self-fulfilling prophecy. It had always been thus. The fact that the world was ending changed nothing. As Sparky kept ticking down the list, telling each person what they would be doing in the coming weeks, she kept feeling more and more the point of focus precisely because she hadn't been focused on yet. And when it became clear that she was last on Sparky's list, she had a good long while, as he talked to Margaret and June and Marco, to wonder what that meant. Being Dinah, her first assumption was that she was considered so important that she was being saved for last. But by the time Sparky finally spoke her name, she had arrived at a different guess as to what was happening. Her heart was already thumping, and her pinkies tingling, her tongue bulky in her mouth.
"Dinah," Sparky said, "you're indispensable."
She knew exactly what this meant, in meeting speak. They would push her out the airlock if they could.
"You have such a wide range of capabilities, and we all admire your attitude so much."
Sparky hadn't said a word to anyone else about their attitude.
"Obviously, asteroid mining, which you've devoted so much of your career to, is a project with a long-term payoff. But we are in short-term mode now."
"Of course."
"I am detailing you to assist Ivy and look for ways that you can put your amazing skill set to use in supporting the activities of the others. Fyodor and Zeke can only go on so many spacewalks. Maybe your robots can be put to use doing things that they can't."
"As long as it involves cutting through iron, they'll be awesome," Dinah said.
"Sounds great,"
Sparky said, missing the sarcasm entirely. In his own mind, he was finished with the conversation, tolerating a few moments' small talk before the after-meeting with Dube and Conrad. Dinah thought better of herself than this. How could she let herself get into this frame of mind at such a time? Because maybe there was actually a good reason for how she was feeling. She was halfway through saying goodbye to Sparky when she pivoted back. "Hang on a sec," she said. "I respect what you said about short-term mode. I get that. But if or when this cloud arc thing works, you know what's next, right?" Sparky was in no mood. Not so much annoyed with her as bewildered.
"What's next?"
"People need a place to live. And if the surface of the Earth is going to be burned off, we're going to have to make those living places up here out of the stuff we can get our hands on. Asteroids. Of which we have a lot more now, thanks to the agent." Sparky put his hands over his face, exhaled, and sat motionless for about a minute. When he took his hands away, she could see he'd been weeping.
"I wrote half a dozen goodbye letters to old friends and family before this meeting," he said. "And when it's over, I'm going to keep working my way down the list. Maybe I'll write half of all the letters I want before their intended recipients get killed by the hard rain. The point being, I guess, that I am thinking like the dead man walking that I truly am. Which is wrong. I should be thinking about what you are thinking about. The future that you and a few others may look forward to if all of this other stuff works."
"You really think we're looking forward to it?" Sparky winced.
"Not in the sense of thinking that that future is going to be great, but in the sense of at least thinking about it. I don't disagree with you. But what do you want me to do now?"
"Watch my back," Dinah said. "Don't let them ditch Amalthea. Don't let them cut up all of my robots for spare parts. You want me to work on other stuff for a while? Fine. But when the sky turns white and the hard rain begins to fall,
The Cloud Arc needs to have a viable program for making things out of asteroids, or else there is no way people are going to stay alive up here for thousands of years.
I have your back, Dinah, said Sparky, for what that is worth.
And his eyes strayed in the direction of the door through which the president had exited. At A plus zero, the 12-person crew of the International Space Station had included only a single Russian, Lieutenant Colonel Fyodor Antonovich Panteleimon, a 55-year-old veteran of 6 missions and 18 spacewalks, the Almanach Gris of the Cosmonaut Corps. This was unusual. In the early years, out of the ISS' usual crew of 6, at least 2 had normally been cosmonauts. The addition of Project Amalthea and the Taurus had expanded the station's maximum capacity to 14, and the number of Russians had typically varied between 2 and 5. The moon had disintegrated only 2 weeks before Ivy, Conrad, and Lena had been scheduled to return home, to be replaced by 2 more Russians and a British engineer. Since that rocket and its crew were ready to go anyway, Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, went ahead and launched it from the Baikonur Cosmodrome on A plus 0.17. The Soyuz spacecraft docked at Izzy's hub module without incident. Unlike Americans, who liked flying things by hand, the Russians had made docking into an automated process a long time ago. The Soyuz, the workhorse for decades of human space launch, was a stack of 3 modules. At its aft end was a mechanical section containing engines, propellant tanks, and photovoltaic panels, and other equipment that didn't require an atmosphere. Its forward section was a more or less spherical vessel meant to be pressurized with breathable air and containing enough empty space for cosmonauts to move around, work, and live. In the middle was a smaller bell-shaped section containing 3 couches where the space-suited occupants would ride into space and later descend back to Earth, cloaked in a fiery comet tail. Accommodations in that section were extremely cramped, but it didn't matter since it was only used briefly during launch and re-entry. The orbital module, which was the larger sphere on the front, was where the cosmonauts spent most of their time, and on its nose was the mating contraption that enabled it to connect with the space station, or any other object suitably equipped. Until a couple of years ago, the Soyuz capsules had usually docked at the aft end of the Zvezda module, which had been the tail of the ISS. More recently, a new module called the Hub had been attached to the Zvezda, extending the main axis of the space station rearward and providing the axle around which the Taurus revolved. In order to maintain compatibility with the ubiquitous and time-tested Soyuz, the Hub had been equipped with a suitable port and hatch. Since the other 11 were busy with the task that Sparky had given them, Dinah floated aft down the whole length of Izzy, for her shop was attached to its forward end, and opened the docking hatch to greet the new arrivals. She was expecting to see a few humans floating free in the orbital module of the newly arrived Soyuz. Instead, she saw the head and arm of a single cosmonaut, whom she vaguely recognized as Maxim Koshalev. He was embedded in a nearly solid mass of vitamins. Vitamins was a term of art used by spaceflight geeks to mean any small, lightweight stuff of extraordinary value. Microchips, medicine, spare parts, ukuleles, biological samples, soap, and food all fell under the general heading of vitamins. Humans, of course, were the most important vitamin of all, unless you were one of those who believed that all space exploration should be conducted by robots. Dinah had sat in many a conference where her colleagues in the asteroid mining industry had argued passionately that rockets, which were so expensive, should only be used to transport vitamins. Bulk materials, such as metals and water, should never be launched from the ground. They ought to be obtained from the billions of rocks that were wandering around in space already. A sealed box of hypodermic syringes tumbled out and caromed off her forehead, followed by a vac-packed bag of lithium hydroxide gravel, a bottle of morphine,
a reel of surface mount capacitors, and a rubber-banded bundle of number 2 lead pencils, pre-sharpened. Once Dinah had pawed those out of the way, she was able to more fully take in the scene. Maxime, jammed in a narrow human-sized tunnel through a mass of vitamins that had been packed into the Soyuz until it couldn't hold any more. Someone down in Tire Tom had had the foresight to cram in a few folded-up garbage bags. Taking the hint, Dinah peeled one of them open and used it to corral all the items that had escaped so far and were threatening to go on a random walk around Izzy. Then she began raking out more. Lots of stuff escaped, but most of it went into the bag. Maxime eased himself out into the hub for a stretch. He'd been crammed into this thing for 6 hours. Dinah, who was smaller, went into the space he'd vacated and began throwing vitamins out to him. He just held up a garbage bag to catch them. After a minute, she excavated a human thigh in a blue jumpsuit, then a shoulder, then an arm. The arm moved and pushed more vitamins at her, exposing a face that Dinah recognized from having scanned her Wikipedia entry half an hour ago. This was Bolor Erdina, a woman who had once been rejected from the cosmonaut program because she was too small to fit into any of the standard spacesuits. She was riding in a couch that had clearly been jury-rigged for the purpose. It was strapped to a part of the orbital module called the divan, with an improvised scheme of cargo webbing that was still dusty from the roads of Kazakhstan. Dinah wondered if it was the last dirt she would ever see, then tried to suppress that thought. So, both Bolor Erdina and Maxim had ridden in the orbital module, which was unprecedented. Humans were supposed to ride only in the re-entry module aft of it. It would have been indiscreet to point this out, but those two, by riding up front, had signed up for a one-way journey that could have turned into a suicide mission had anything gone wrong. The orbital module was jettisoned during the re-entry process and burned up in the atmosphere. Only the passengers in the re-entry module could even theoretically make it back alive. The vitamin bagging proceeded through the hatch into the re-entry module and went viral as faces and arms were freed. In the 3 couches where humans were supposed to ride were the 2 other scheduled cosmonauts, Yuri and Vyacheslav, and the Brit, who was named Reese. Bolor Erdina, Yuri, and Vyacheslav took their first chance to unstrap and move up through the orbital module into the hub. Reese requested that he be given a moment. Dinah went into the hub to greet the other 4. In normal times, these moments were at least a little bit ceremonious, with the new arrivals being greeted with hugs or at least high fives as they glided through the hatch and photographs taken. The impending deaths of everyone on Earth cast a bit of a pall over this occasion, but Dinah felt she should at least say a few words to each of them. Bolor Erdina urged Dinah to address her as Bo. She was obviously of Far Eastern stock, and yet there was something in her eyes and cheekbones that did not look precisely Chinese. Dinah's preliminary Googling had already told her that Bo was Mongolian. Yuri and Maxim were coming to the ISS for their 3rd and 4th times, respectively. Vyacheslav seemed to be a last-minute substitution for a younger cosmonaut who would have been making his first trip to the ISS. Vyacheslav had done 2 previous stints. So, all the Russians except for Bo were old hands at this. And once they'd exchanged brief greetings with Dinah, they glided through the middle of the hub, looking about curiously since some of them hadn't seen it before, and then through the hatch into the Zvezda module, which was like home to them. They exchanged clipped remarks in Russian, of which Dinah understood about 50%. Everyone who worked on Izzy had to have at least a working knowledge of Russian. Reese Aitken was an engineer who had made a career of building strange new constructs, usually for wealthy clients. Until 17 days ago, his mission had been to lay groundwork for the addition of a 2nd larger Taurus, built around a newer hub aft of the existing one, and intended for space tourists. This was part of a public-private partnership between NASA and Reese's employer, a British billionaire who had been one of the early movers in the space tourism industry. Reese had a new mission now, but he was still a perfect fit for the job. Dinah went back through the orbital module and peered through the hatch at him, lying there patiently motionless in his couch.
"First time in space?"
Dinah asked him, though she already knew the answer.
"Don't you have Google up here?"
he responded. From an American, it would have been simply obnoxious, but Dinah had spent enough time around Brits to take it as intended. "You just don't seem very eager to explore your new home."
"I'm stretching it out. The process of discovery. Besides, I was warned not to move my head."
"To avoid nausea. Yeah, that's good advice," Dinah said. "But you have to move it eventually."
A loose packet of cucumber seeds, stenciled in Cyrillic, floated past her head. She plucked it carefully out of the air. Finding herself in range, she stuck out her hand.
"Dinah," she said.
"Reese."
He extended his hand while gazing rigidly ahead, as he'd been instructed. But in the time-honored manner of most human males, he allowed his eyeballs to swivel her way so that he could check her out, then turned his head so that he could check her out better.
"You're going to regret that," she said.
"Oh, my goodness,"
he exclaimed.
"You have a few minutes before it all comes up. Come on out. I'll get you a bag."
During one of many recent sleepless nights, Dinah had found herself worrying about transistors. Modern semiconductor technology had found a way to make them very small. So small that they could be destroyed by a single hit from a cosmic ray. This didn't matter much down on the ground, because the stakes were lower and cosmic rays were mostly blocked by the atmosphere. But electronics that had to work in space were a different matter. The world's military-industrial complexes had put a lot of money and brain power into making rad-hard electronics, more resistant to cosmic ray strikes. The resulting chips and circuit boards were, by and large, clunkier than the sleek consumer electronics that Earthbound customers had come to expect. A lot more expensive, too. So much so that Dinah had avoided using them at all in her robots. She used cheap, tiny, off-the-shelf electronics in the expectation that a certain number of her robots would be found dead every week. A functional robot could carry a dead one back to the little airlock between Dinah's workshop and the pitted surface of Amalthea. And Dinah could swap its fried circuit board out for a new one. Sometimes the new one would already be dead, struck by a cosmic ray while it was just sitting there in storage. But the vitamins shipped up on the ISS supply missions always had more of them. The only shielding from cosmic rays was matter. A thick atmosphere, such as Earth's, would do the trick, or a much thinner bulwark of solid, heavy material. Of course, Dinah happened to have one in the form of Amalthea itself. Any object nestled up against Amalthea's surface would be shielded from cosmic rays coming from roughly half of the universe, the half blocked from view by the asteroid. For the same reason, the ISS was always shielded by the Earth from any cosmic rays approaching from that direction. So there was a sweet spot on the side of Dinah's shop that faced toward Earth but was under the bulk of Amalthea, where cosmic rays could only squirt in from a relatively narrow band of space. Dinah stored her spare chips and circuit boards in that general area, just to improve their odds. And she limited the amount of time that her robots spent roaming about on the side of Amalthea that faced deep space. In clear view of her window was a hollow in Amalthea's side, perhaps an ancient impact crater, big enough to accommodate a watermelon. On day 9, 5 days before the conference in the banana, when Doc Dubois had told them about the hard rain, and the president had told them that they were never coming home, she had programmed several of her robots, the ones with the most effective cutting heads, to begin making that hollow deeper. Perhaps she'd had a premonition of what was about to happen, or perhaps she was just doing her job. Mining robots would need to have the ability to carry out programmed activities such as boring tunnels into rock, and it was high time she began experimenting with such tasks. But after that conference in the banana, she had gone back to her little shop and, as an alternative to crying all night or sticking her head out the airlock, she had altered the program that those little robots were following and told them to begin bending the tunnel curving it gently as it delved into the asteroid. Until then, the robots had been moving directly away from her, and she'd been able to look through her tiny quartz window into the watermelon-sized hollow and straight down the tunnel that the robots were cutting. She had to flip a welding glass down over the window when she did this because they were cutting with plasma arcs whose brilliant purple light would burn her eyes. But by the time that the five new arrivals got to Izzy on A plus 0.17, the robots had disappeared around the bend in the tunnel that they had made. The universe could not see them. Cosmic rays ran in straight lines, like light, and they could not negotiate that bend. Dinah had them carve a little hollow into the side of that tunnel. A storage niche. She packaged up all of her spare chips and PC boards into a bundle. It was a small one, given how tiny and powerful modern chips were. A cube small enough to hold in one hand. Normally, this would have been a bad idea. A single cosmic ray might shoot through the entire stack and kill every board at once. She handed it off to an eight-legged robot and sent that robot through the airlock and down the tunnel.